Let's start with the numbers. So it looks like North Carolina will hit 50,000 new COVID-19 cases sometime this weekend. There's a record number of people in the hospital. And before we hit the record button, you brought up something I want you to talk about, and that's hospital reporting.
I look at the data every day. And, you know, so first off, we have 871 folks who are currently hospitalized as of Friday. And it says here 91% of hospitals reporting. Like any good reporter, I've developed contacts over the years, and I have some folks who send me information. I won't say who they are or what hospitals they send me information on, but I get folks who send me, it's like, hey, here's the screenshot of our hospital's dashboard. And it's very interesting. You can kind of see how many ICU cases a hospital has or how many COVID patients are on the floor. And what I've realized as I'm looking at this type of data that people send me from around the state, that there's definitely, and there always has been, but this, once again, it gets revealed, the have and have not in the hospital space, where you have a wealthy hospital that has the ability to have someone program their electronic health records to automatically populate their dashboard so they can see, you know, they don't have to have someone crunching the numbers. It just comes straight out of their EHR into the dashboard so they can see, like, how many patients are in the ICU, how many patients have been tested today. And then that stuff gets automatically uploaded to the state. I would bet you that the 9% of hospitals that are not reporting are smaller hospitals where there might be one or two patients or maybe none, but that they probably have to pull some poor administrative staffer to, you know, say, okay, we've got, you know, three COVID patients in the hospital, one's in the ICU, two are on the floor, and they collate that data and they fax it to the state. And they probably don't do it every day. So once again, it's like rich hospitals versus not so wealthy hospitals. And I see that as one of the kind of sub stories to this whole pandemic.
You know, that also seems to be playing out in new case reporting by local health departments. And your reporter, Hannah Critchfield, has a piece looking at how that impacts state race and ethnicity data.
Absolutely. I mean, what people don't realize is that, you know, I think folks think, oh, there's some great computer system and Big Brother is watching all of us. But when you go to a local county health department, again, especially in smaller counties, you know, there it's peopled with nurses, maybe a couple epidemiologists, and they are doing a lot of this stuff on paper. I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, Gibby Harris, who used to be the health director there in Buncombe County, who's now, she retired, but she couldn't stay in retirement for long. She's now the health director in Mecklenburg. And at the very beginning of the pandemic, she talked about the fact that they had seven contact tracers on their staff to cover a city of 1.1 million. So obviously that's changed. But, you know, you have these people who go out, they make phone calls, they collate the data. Maybe they have a database within their office, and then they have to collate it and send it to the state. And maybe the contact tracers asked about race and ethnicity, and maybe they didn't. It's only in the past week or so that the federal government has required labs like LabCorp or Quest to collect ethnicity and race data on their patients who are getting COVID tests. So that means that about a third of the positive tests that we have in North Carolina, we don't know what race they are or what ethnicity they are. There's some overlap. It's like 14,000 that we don't know the race. There's like 15,000 we don't know the ethnicity. I'm guessing that there's overlap in those two groups. So I don't know what the total number is that we're missing some of this data. But, you know, this is important stuff, especially as we're looking at a pandemic that's disproportionately affecting some groups over others. Now, of course, the feds are requiring this and we'll get better data going forward. But it's been a process. I mean, I keep telling people, this has been a process. It's been a learning curve. You know, people came to the pandemic with the resources that they had, and sometimes that wasn't a lot.
Okay, speaking of a lot, we heard a lot about face coverings this week. It seems the word of the week was mask.
It really was. I mean, the secretary talked about it, Secretary Cohen. She even gave a mask demo during yesterday's press availability, you know, how to put the mask on, how to take the mask off. You know, there are some states, Virginia, New York, California, where if you're out in public, you're required to have a mask with you. And there's data coming back. There's German data. There's some data from France. It's looking at how many cases may have been avoided by the fact that everyone wears them. And again, me wearing a mask is not protecting me. Me wearing a mask is protecting you from me, because I may have COVID and be either pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic. So I don't know if I'm spreading it to you or not. You know, and it's the kind of thing, like, my street's pretty quiet. So if I'm walking the dog on my street, I'm not wearing the mask. But if I go to downtown, heck yeah, I'm wearing a mask. If I'm going to the grocery store, oh yeah, I'm wearing a mask. The other day, and we were in a store, and like no staff in the store were wearing it. And there were only a handful of customers who were wearing them.
So speaking of wearing a mask, you and I both heard during a couple of news briefings, Governor Roy Cooper hinting a mask mandate may be in the cards for North Carolina.
He certainly was dropping some broad hints, you know, and someone said to him yesterday, like, why not just, you know, make the mandate? And Cooper came back and he said, you know, you can't just wave a wand and make a law happen or make a policy happen. You have to take into consideration different things. And to wit, you know, I sat and I listened into a webinar this week on people with disabilities and COVID. And the presenter is a researcher at Harvard who is a woman with a disability, and she has a physical disability. But, you know, there's folks who may have respiratory problems, which would be invisible, right? So if they're out in public and they're not wearing a mask and they have and they're not wearing a mask because they have asthma, like, are people going to give them a hard time? You know, do you wear a little wristband saying, I'm exempt? So there's a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration, but it sure felt like he was about to say that next week we might see a mask mandate.
So we've heard a lot about how the coronavirus pandemic is impacting schools, childcare, and this week you have a piece about the impact on something we haven't heard a lot about, and that's foster care.
And, you know, that story came out of a reader who wrote and said, you know, I've got this foster child, I'm older, we have another child in the household who has a respiratory problem, and the youngest foster child we have is supposed to be going on visits with the family, but we don't have any control over whether or not this child will be monitored, or will there be masks, will there be social distancing. I will say, if you read through that story, you know, the thing that everyone has said that was success were the televisits. You know, usually when you have a kid in foster care, there's a mandate for visitation by the biological family, and the foster family complies. And the foster family is, you know, usually like ferrying this child around. They might be doing medical appointments. They frequently have therapy appointments if these kids have had any trauma that they're trying to deal with. And then, you know, Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, they go and they have their visit with their biological parent for an hour. And two separate foster parents that I spoke to said that they jumped on to doing televisits with their foster child's biological families. And they said they went really well. And the biological families were really happy with them. They got to know one another. There was a level of trust that was created between the foster family and the biological family. So the biological family felt more comfortable, like, oh, like, this is who's taking care of my child while I kind of get my life together. And then they were able to visit more frequently. So it wasn't just for an hour on Saturday afternoon. It was a half hour on Tuesday and maybe 45 minutes on Thursday. And it wasn't limited by being at a third party site where that, you know, someone comes in and says, okay, your 30 minutes are up. You know, they were able to go over a little bit and visit more frequently and see the child more frequently. Even if they couldn't hug him, they could, you know, talk to him or, you know, teach their ABCs together. So that was really interesting. But, you know, there's been all of these problems with the system and implementation. I'm writing a second part to that story, which will run next week, talking about issues with getting new families into the foster care pipeline and some really chilling data on the drop in the number of child abuse reports. There's a real worry that there is a hidden epidemic out there of child abuse that's not being picked up, you know, by teachers and pediatricians who would see it otherwise.
All right. Thanks so much for your reporting on both these issues. And what else is your team working on for next week?
We've got some other stuff on children. One about, like, you know, kids being lonely. I think we've got some more stuff coming about the prison system. We're keeping up our coverage of some of a, well, it's a hospital in another part of the state, but the potential partnership and or sale of New Hanover Regional. So we're keeping our eye on a lot of different things. And then, of course, some of my reporters are kind of getting back to, quote, regularly scheduled programming. So we'll have a story about PFAS, which are the per and polyfluorinated compounds that are in the water in the Cape Fear River and turns out in the Yadkin River. And I think once we start scratching the surface, we're going to find them in other places as well.